Right now, water quality in Park City has proven challenging over the years, whether it's arsenic or antimony in the water. City officials spending millions of dollars to meet state and federal water quality standards. The city recently issued its annual Water Consumer Confidence Report. In the studio to tell us about how we did, Water Quality Program Manager Michelle DeHaan. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy birthday to KPCW.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
You bet.
The good news is that Park City's water has met or exceeded the water quality standards. These are set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as well as the Utah Division of Drinking Water. Mostly that's because we're using treated water, either from the Jordanelle or from the water that we're pulling out of Rockport.
Yes, that's correct, Leslie. I wanted to just highlight first that the drinking water quality is, you know, currently one of the top priorities for the Public Utilities Department. And we do have a complicated source blend that we have to manage within our distribution system throughout the city. One of the things that the annual Consumer Confidence Report highlights right off the bat is we are meeting compliance with all standards, whether it's the state or the EPA's, and we're doing a really good job with that. Challenges that you mentioned in the past are things that we clearly understand and are mitigating risks to provide the best drinking water we can for the community.
Yeah. Again, are we testing water coming from either the Judge, which now is just basically flowing downstream, I guess?
That's correct. The Judge Tunnel is one of the essential supplies for Park City, and we did take it out of the system in 2013. And one of the things that we are doing is working really hard on the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant, which is a significant investment by the city for treating both Judge and Spiro Tunnel waters. It's essentially a third of our potable supply for the city and really important sources for us. So we will be bringing those that plant online and approximately 2021-22 time frame and demolishing the Spiro Tunnel water treatment plant this September.
So okay. So the Judge water then will flow to the new Three Kings treatment plant to bring that back on, because that's what we've got problems with. What? Arsenic in that one?
Yep. There's actually arsenic, antimony. We've got some trace levels of lead in drinking water within that particular source that will be removed, of course. And also things like zinc and cadmium that are important to the watershed throughout McLeod. So that's one of the reasons that we're treating to such stringent standards at the new Three Kings plant.
Okay. And again, I mean, here we are halfway through 2019. This report is for 2018. So that's when all of the testing was done. I mean, and we just know that it's good now, a year later?
So the EPA requires that we report on the year previous to the entire calendar year previous to the July 1 deadline for this report that is issued annually as required by EPA. And we actually continue to do testing, of course, since that time frame. And we do that in the distribution system above and beyond drinking water standards. So we have a good understanding of the water quality that's being served to the households. And we also continue to sample at the sources where we collect the samples for the detections that are listed within the water quality report. And I'll just mention that the table that's required in that report is lengthy, but it's essentially the contaminants that are in drinking water beyond H2O, so that we have, you know, things like, you know, with the Weber River water, it runs through soils and, you know, is exposed to different contaminants that we manage at the treatment plants. Another example would be at the Creekside Water Treatment Plant, where it's exposed to surface water, well water that's under the influence of surface water. And so we do pick up different contaminants that are listed within that table, but they do all meet drinking water standards. They're just detected contaminants.
Yeah, what does that mean when to have the surface water contaminated by surface water?
Yeah, so, you know, surface water is exposed to things like minerals, including things like manganese and different color tannins, things like that, that we can remove in drinking water through the treatment process. It can be exposed to pathogens, of course. You know, we have livestock and cattle on the watershed above our intake on Rockport. So all of these things are important in the advanced treatment technologies that we do apply, like at the Quinns Junction Water Treatment Plant adjacent to the rail trail.
Okay. There's a big headline across the top of the report, drink local tap water. Why is that important?
Well, number one, it's important because, you know, our customers do pay for high-quality drinking water. And, you know, I think it's important to the community that we understand that the drinking water in Park City is safe to drink and does meet drinking water standards. And I think it's also, you know, we also want to plug the conservation piece with regard to thinking about things like avoiding use of plastic throwaway water bottles. And you might see some of the trucks driving around town right now with city water having new wraps on the side that talk about things like water conservation and utilizing refillable water bottles with tap waters to encourage that.
Yeah. Now, you're required to do the water quality reporting. What about taste? I mean, if Park City were to be put in into a taste test, how would we rank there?
So everybody has different opinions about taste in drinking water because we all came from somewhere different, or if we lived locally, we are very used to the taste of the water. So it's different in different communities. We have very hard water in Park City, so that's one of the things living in a desert environment. You know, essentially mountain on the one side of the highway and desert on the other. The soils that we have, both in the surface water and in the groundwater locally, do have very hard water. So that's one of the things we actually talk about in the report, and so we can educate our customers about that. But that's the one thing from a taste perspective that people might notice. We also utilize chlorine as a disinfectant in our drinking water. So some people notice that as a taste issue as well.
Yeah, I mean, from living from Old Town, when we used to drink the Judge water, I mean, it was cold, crisp, and I guess full of stuff we shouldn't be drinking. But at the same time, the stuff now, it just, you know, right out of the tap feels warm and, I don't know, stagnant almost.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. We do have to blend a lot of different water supplies. We have 7 different water supplies within the city. And one of the things you mentioned with the Judge Tunnel water and Spiro Tunnel water is actually it's very cold compared to other water sources. And sometimes in the winter, you notice it's colder as well because of the fact that the Weber River water is a lot colder. So you'll have shifts in temperature, and colder water actually does mask the flavor of taste. So essentially, when you have warmer water, you have different flavors that you can get from drinking water. So it's a great observation on your part.
But you don't add anything. I mean, there is a water brand out there, you know, that distills the water and then adds in the electrolytes. I mean, that's not something the city does.
No. That would be an expensive way to have safe drinking water and for, obviously, irrigation. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because you see reports about the safety of drinking water, right? I mean, you do have to meet federal standards and local standards, whereas bottled water doesn't have to?
So EPA regulates the Safe Drinking Water Act, and that's what we have to comply with. The FDA actually has to regulate the bottled water industry, and they have the exact same requirements upon them that they have to maintain. I will say that the EPA is much more stringent in requiring the regulations with regard to safe drinking water, but we do talk about that with bottled water. It goes through the same kind of concepts where it's coming from somewhere that's running through rivers and streams or a well water or spring or something like that. So.
The city also conducting lead and copper testing at designated residents this summer. Why are we doing that?
The EPA requires that we collect samples every 3 years in the summer months because that's when you have the highest potential risk of leaching from lead solder off of copper pipes, and that's the time frame that you have the potential highest risk. So we have a pool of 20 households that have been selected based on when the homes were built. So for example, in the time frame of 1983 to 1990, those are the households that we target for selection because that's the time period when lead solder could have been utilized in household plumbing. And we know that there are really good things about the pipe materials within Park City. There are no lead service lines locally. So what we target is households that have copper plumbing within their household and have the potential for lead solder. And the good news is 3 years ago when we did this testing, the levels are extremely low. So the drinking water standard is 15 currently. EPA is reassessing that because they do feel like there is no safe amount of lead for children in drinking water. And our concentrations are in the realm of 2 micrograms per liter compared to the 15 microgram per liter standard that's in place. And we also tested within city buildings that the public is exposed to, like the library, the MARC, the ice rink, MARSAC building, and those results are very similar in nature.
So is it possible for Park City to have some kind of Flint, Michigan or Sandy, Utah problem?
It's a good question, Leslie. One of the things that we do is avoid that situation by understanding the risks that we have within our own system because they're unique. And we are very good at mitigating the risks in the way that we deliver water within the system and ensuring we have appropriate blends of water quality. So essentially, all of our water sources play nice together in the distribution system. We have a lot of monitoring that we conduct. We have online sensors in the distribution system. Our staff is monitoring continuously. And we do things like maintain a corrosion control program. And that's one of the challenges they ran into in Flint, Michigan, where we actually have a program where we ensure that any metals that happen to be in our distribution system stay on the pipe walls through applying higher chlorine concentrations in the water system, and then also have an annual flushing program that allows us to scour the pipes and remove any loose metals that could be on the pipe walls. So those kind of situations with Flint, Michigan and Sandy City will be avoided here in Park City because of our diligent programs that we do have in place.
Okay, so Sandy and Flint weren't doing similar programs like that, the scrubbing of the lines.
Yeah, so in Flint, Michigan, you know, the big deal is they did have lead service lines, which we don't have in Park City, and they switched water sources. And when they did that, they had corrosion control in place prior to the change in water supply, and then they did not apply corrosion control with a chemical called phosphate that essentially coats the pipe walls. In Sandy City's case, the big difference is they actually overfed fluoride into their distribution system. We don't utilize fluoride as an additive in our water system. And the chemical that's used to add fluoride is acid. And when they do that, they dropped the pH significantly in their water distribution system, which caused a release of metals in their distribution system, including lead and copper.
The city also embarking on a continuous improvement voluntary optimization standard adoption. What does that even mean?
So one of the things that we do is, again, we're doing a really good job meeting compliance. What we want to do is continuously make a commitment to the citizens for excellence when it comes to optimizing our treatment plants and our distribution system management. There's programs like with the Utah Water Quality Alliance and the Partnership for Safe Water, where we intend to join over 300 utilities nationwide who are committing to excellence through adoption of aggressive standards that are beyond drinking water regulations and essentially wanting to be part of the best of the community in the water industry.
Okay. With the current federal administration, we have seen the Environmental Protection Agency laxing regulations across the board. Will we see this with water supply as well?
So one of the things that we have to think about, and the reason that we do embark on programs like the Partnership for Safe Water, is that these the organizations that are part of that do keep a close eye on the potential pending regulations that could be coming to us in drinking water in future years, even though there's little activity essentially on the Hill with regard to new regulations. So we're trying to identify what potential risks there are, like things like harmful algal blooms that we hear about sometimes as spring comes on, that people see, you know, algae out on the watershed. And we have a good understanding of that group of contaminants that aren't currently regulated and how we can mitigate any potential risks from cyanotoxins and harmful algal blooms that could exist. So that's an example of contaminants that aren't currently regulated, but we are watching very closely in our efforts to work with the EPA Office of standards and regulations that set the standards. So I'm actively involved in a lot of the committees nationally that track that information, and it helps us stay in front of the regulations if they do come out more stringent in the future.
Okay. Bloods Lake up at Bonanza Flat that the city now owns, is that, do we test that at all? Because I know that we got a lot of money to protect the watershed there.
Yeah, so that's obviously one of our reservoirs at the highest part of our distribution system. We don't specifically target testing at that tank on a routine basis, but we do actually have a tank cleaning program. And so when we do the tank cleaning, we literally send divers in there, and we send them in with sample bottles to collect water quality from each one of the tanks that we go through cleaning on. And that helps us understand if there's any sediment or any material that we need to remove through the diving process when they go through the tank cleaning. So that's one of the tests that we do complete at that tank. But generally speaking, the distribution system sampling that we do throughout the distribution system provides us the information we need to know whether there's anything compromised at a tank like that.
Okay. Michelle, anything else you wanted to mention?
I'd be remiss in just mentioning that, you know, the Three Kings Project is one of the projects that is super important in our compliance with stream water standards and continued supply for the city. The other thing I'm really targeting moving forward is our advanced main cleaning program, when we will be looking at swabbing or ice pigging the water distribution system, because that's a really important project to the city once we knock the Spiro water treatment plant down, so we're not potentially having any trace contaminants of any metals going into the distribution system.
Okay.
So appreciate your time today, Leslie, and again, happy birthday to KPCW.
Michelle DeHaan, again, is the Water Quality and Treatment Manager for Park City Municipal. Thanks. 8:32 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Utah's Tax Restructuring and Equalization Task Force was formed after the plug was pulled on a bill to change the sales tax structure this past legislative session. The task force has hit the road this summer to get the public's thoughts on what this restructure should look like. Joining me now on phone, I have Representative Tim Quinn. He is the sponsor of the bill that was heard earlier this year. He's also a task force member and a legislator for Wasatch and Summit counties. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Hey, it's been a while since the legislative session had everybody abuz with this tax talks. Just begin by reminding us what you are trying to address here with the tax reform effort.
Great. Thank you. First off, I just want to reiterate, this is not to raise revenue. So many of the people in the meetings that we've attended over the last week or so keep talking about, well, if you need more money, we don't, in my opinion, and most of the legislative opinions, we don't need more money. We just need to come in from a different source. Most of your listeners know and realize we have a constitutional requirement to spend all of income tax dollars on education, both K through 12 and higher ed. And then everything else is funded through sales tax primarily. And that's the fund that's suffering. With Medicaid expansion this past year from the voters, ever-increasing demand on our roads, and we needed to keep up with that infrastructure, social services, the courts, prisons, everything else we do as a government is funded through the sales tax, and sales tax isn't keeping up. When we look at as a percentage of GDP, when we look at a percentage of personal income, we look at a percentage of the state budget, state revenue, it's falling behind, and we just need to have a shift in income tax dollars and sales tax dollars. So that's what the bill was trying to do.
Yeah, so as we look towards this shift of where we would collect these tax dollars, especially the sales tax dollars, I mean, who will be most impacted by what's you know, what we're thinking about?
Well, let me reiterate this as well. The tax reform task force that I'm a member of, we're starting with a clean slate. We're not looking at 441, that bill that you talked about of mine that was pulled in the session. We're not looking at that as a starting point. Now, I think it would be disingenuous to say, well, we're not going to use some of that data and some of that experience and maybe even some of the points of 441 in our ultimate resolution, but we're starting with a clean slate. I mean, there's proposals to raise a statewide property tax. There's proposals to restore sales tax on food completely. There's a proposal to, again, tax some services, as 441 went to do. and many removing the firewall, the constitutional firewall between education and the income tax. So there's a lot there that we have to consider, and that's what we've been doing, going around the state saying, hey, here's the problem. Help us come up with a solution. Give us your feedback on what you know and what you've heard, and hopefully in a month or two or three we'll have a consensus thought and a solution that will be beneficial to everyone in the state of Utah.
Are there elements then of House Bill 411 that you think should remain in the new bill?
Yes, absolutely. And one of those is, or several of those are, a component of that bill was to increase the threshold on Social Security, people who are on Social Security, what they can earn before we tax those benefits. We were going to increase that threshold, which I think is a good thing for the seniors in the state. There was the restoration of the child tax exemption that was taken away during the federal reform of 2017. That would be a big savings for families in Utah. And as far as the sales tax on services, I do think and continue to think that there are areas we need to look at, maybe not as expansive as 441 was, but I'll give you an easy example. When you and I, Leslie, were growing up, and I'm older than you, but when we were growing up, we would buy an album if we wanted to listen to music, and we paid a sales tax. Today, we subscribe to a streaming service, and there's no sales tax. So there are a lot of things that we used to tax that was a good that now has become a service, and I think we need to look at changing our tax code to reflect that change in the economy.
Four town halls have already been held across the state. More are planned throughout July. None planned for Summit or Wasatch County. Your district, how come?
Well, we tried to hit geographically every corner of the state. We started in Brigham City. We went to Kearns for our Salt Lake meeting. We went to Richfield, kind of one of the rural areas we are going to hit. Then we went to St. George. We'll come back to Layton in the Davis and Weber area. We will go to Roosevelt and Moab and then end up in Utah County. So we tried to hit kind of a varied area of the state, and then the mass populations of the state, and Summit and Wasatch just didn't make it. I know that I saw Glenn Wright and Roger down at the one in Kearns, which I think was the closest one to Park City. So they were there representing you guys, and hopefully my presence on the task force will help represent some of the people of Park City and Wasatch as well.
One of the problems with House Bill 441 during the session was that the public was just caught off guard and didn't really have time to digest the enormous bill. How will the public's comments and concerns from these town halls be taken into consideration for any future legislation?
Well, and you're right. The public did think that it was a bit rushed, although some of the comments in those meetings have been, hey, why do you have to do this now? If it's good policy this year, it'll be good policy next year, it'll be good policy in 5 years. And our response, or at least my response is you know, Washington, D.C., there's not a member of Congress's shoes that aren't scuffed from continually kicking down the road this can, whatever the problem is of the day. Utah, we've been the number one ranked state, fiscally managed state in the country 12 years in a row, because I think we do try to make the tough decisions, the hard choices, before the crisis hits. So we have a very good year in revenue. It's a perfect opportunity to restructure some things and move those monies around, not collect new monies, but move them around. So the comments that they've made, we have been listening. We have been taking notes. They've all been recorded. After those town halls, when we meet again publicly as a task force, we will take those notes, those comments, those suggestions, and it certainly will be part of how we derive and come up with a solution.
Now, there aren't a lot of Democrats on the task force or women, so are we missing some valuable perspectives from the conversation?
Well, that's been one of the concerns brought up by one of the legislators. I know for sure about women representation, but as far as the Republican-Democrat mix, I think it's a fairly well represented as far as the mix in the whole legislature. 8 Republicans and 2 Democrats, so 20% Democrat representation. Joe Briscoe and I serve on the Revenue Tax Committee. He's the Democrat from the House. Karen Main, who is the minority leader in the Senate, is representing the Democrats in the Senate. And I think, sure, there could be an argument made, but I believe those two are very capable. Joel and I have a great working relationship. He proposed a carbon tax bill during the session, which, as vice chair of the Rev and Tax, we were excited to hear about. We gave it, I think, about a two-hour committee hearing. And with Joel LaGreen, Representative Briscoe LaGreen, we moved that to the interim to continue to study that. So, yes, while the argument could be made, I still think that both sides are well represented on this task force amongst a wide variety of skill sets, demographic representation, and perspectives on the committee. So I think we'll come up with a good solution for everyone.
So is the plan that any new tax legislation will be addressed in a special session prior to January?
I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. Many have talked about that. That was our hope at the end of the session, is that we would meet in a special session to put this in place. But as we move through this process, it is a very complicated issue. We want to make sure we get it right. We want to be kind of a leader in this amongst the states. All the states are grappling with the same issues that we are as far as this divergence from goods to services. But whether that occurs in a special session or not will be up to House and Senate leadership and certainly the governor. But whether that happens, Leslie, whether we do it in a special session or do it in the next session, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like waiting until January then gives people, again, another opportunity to you know, at least to debate the issue at the committee hearings that would have to be held.
That is a good point, but the other side, the flip side of that coin is if we did it in a special session, it's the only thing that we would do. So it would be given all of the time of a special session. It would have all of the spotlight during a special session. Whereas once we get in that 45-day crunch time, 32 or 33 working days, we're addressing 500, 600, 700, 800 bills. We have people running in every direction. It may not get the attention that it needs. So there's an argument to be made for both ways, and we'll just have to see what leadership wants to do.
As you mentioned, lots of options to consider: dropping the sales, the state constitutional requirement to put income tax toward education, restoring the sales tax on food, perhaps even a carbon tax. Any options that you are leaning toward?
I would rather say there's a few options I'm leaning against.
Okay.
I would not be in favor, and I've made it known. Doesn't mean that it won't be what we ultimately do, because I'm just one member of this task force, and even the task force recommendation, I mean, the entire legislature will vote on it, but I've argued and will continue to argue against the raising the sales tax rate back on food. It's a very regressive tax. We all have to have food. We don't tax pharmaceuticals because they're life-saving, and I would argue there's nothing more life-saving than food. If we restored it back on food, we'd be one of, I think, only 8 or 9 states in the country that do that. And I think we can come up with a better solution than hurting families who are striving to maintain a family budget and put food on the table for their families and their kids. So that would be the one area that I'm extremely opposed to. But again, I'm just one voice out of 104.
Now, this constitutional requirement that, you know, could the legislature can't change that, can it? Doesn't it take a vote of the people?
Exactly. It would have to pass the House with a two-thirds vote. It would have to pass the Senate with a two-thirds vote. And then it would go to the public for a 50+1% vote. And just like back in 96, when the public decided to add higher education to that constitutional requirement, they amended it. They could do it again. But yes, it has to pass the legislature and the public.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the educators would probably argue there's still not enough money in education. Why would we do this? I mean, what do you think some of the reasons are that we do need to change that for?
I think the biggest reason for me to look at this option is to say, I said that tax policy is very complicated. We need to be able to look at our tax policy in a holistic way, not in these silos. We need to look and say, okay, if we do this, how does it affect property tax? And when we do that, how does it affect income tax? And if we do this, how does it affect sales tax? We need to look at that in a holistic way instead of saying, well, keep in mind, whatever we do over here in the income tax, we can't touch it anyway. So that's the main argument for it. But I would also argue that I would like to see, if we go down that road, I would like to see there to have a minimum in place, a floor, if you will, for funding education. If you look over the last 21 years, education has been given 30.47% of our entire state budget on average. One year, I think it was as low as in the 26% range, and a year or two is as high as around almost 32%, but on average, 30.5%. We could find a number that we say, okay, we won't go below this as a percentage of the entire state budget. That way, keep in mind, education is using the income tax, and income tax is the most volatile source of revenue we have in the state. When the economy turns down, and it will at some point, that will be hit the hardest, and that will hit education the hardest. One of the things I want to bring up to the educators, and I want their help, and we had a meeting at the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce where many of the districts were represented, and when I brought this up, a large number of them came up to me and said, Representative, we want to be a part of this discussion. We're not saying we agree, but we certainly don't oppose it, but we want to be part of the solution, and we think, you know, there is a way that we can come together on this, and that's what I hope we have as a collaborative effort. But educators, and maybe some of them are right at different years, you know, say, hey, we don't get enough funding, but don't change the way we do this. If it's such a bad system where we're not funding it the way we appropriately should fund it, then why do you want to keep that system? Maybe there's a better way to fund education to where it unties the legislators' hands, but yet it gives more money to education. So I think it's certainly worthwhile to look at.
Some critics argue that Utah doesn't have a problem on its hands, and really this is an opportunity for the state to reduce its spending. But as you mentioned, we've got some big projects on the horizon. The new state prison, which isn't yet built and already over budget. We've got the inland port, as you mentioned, roads and infrastructure. Is legislative leadership making tax reform an urgent priority to help fund those projects?
I wouldn't say no. And to kind of bring clarity, 441, I brought to the speaker 14 months ago and said, hey, this is a problem I see with this divergence of goods and services and what's it doing to our silos. And then it became a priority. Now, not that I came up with this. They've been talking about this for several years as we've seen trends. The legislative fiscal analysts see trends and what's going on in the economy as a whole. Again, this is not about new revenue. It's about shifting revenue so that it allows us to fund those projects, many of which you just talked about. We know the voters just passed Medicaid expansion last November. That's something that we have to consider in the mix because that's paid out of sales tax. So many do argue, Leslie, that this is not a rush. This is not a priority or a crisis. And it's not a crisis yet. But it will be in two or three more years, and I just don't think we wait two or three more years to come up with a solution. Let's do it now while we have the opportunity to do so.
Okay. Tim, anything else you'd like to update our listeners on?
The only thing I would say is that if any of the listeners have questions or concerns, comments, helpful solutions about this tax issue, or just a comment, I'm more than happy to take a phone call or to respond to an email that they may want to send. So I appreciate the time this morning, Leslie.
Okay. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's State Representative Tim Quinn. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:49. Park City's Egyptian Theater presenting A Chorus Line, playing weekends for the month through July 21st. On the phone with details, I have Egyptian Theater's Artistic and Producing Director, Amber Hansen. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Leslie.
Yeah, so A Chorus Line, one of the longest-running Broadway shows ever. Start by telling us just a bit about the play and why you think it was so popular.
Well, I mean, it's one of my top five musicals of all time, and I think for a lot of people who have seen and loved the show, it's one of the best-written shows of all time. It's very genuine. It's very emotional. It's very relatable, and it's unique in where it's a true ensemble show where there's no one star. Every character on the line, 17 people get their chance in the spotlight and they share their own stories. And it's a very touching show. It's very funny. It's got the show-stopping dance numbers and songs that everybody loves. And it's just one of those shows that kind of change you and if you have a love of musical theater, this is one that should be on your list if you haven't seen it.
Okay. This is being put on by, is it Ziegfeld Theater again, or somebody else doing
correct.
It?
Correct. Correct. However, we are a little bit more involved partner-wise. I've been more involved in their production, and I'm actually the director of this show.
Oh.
So, yeah. So it's more, it's kind of like a Egyptian theater co-production because I've been in charge artistically from the beginning on this show, and then have been producing the last two shows, and going forward we'll be more involved in the productions of from the Ziegfeld Theater. So it's more of like a true partnership.
Yeah. So does the Egyptian have a stage big enough for all 17 of these characters?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some challenges. Coming from the Ziegfeld Theater, their theater is wider but not deeper, so there was challenges there. And then our theater has the lack of width to fit everyone. But we're making creative accommodations, and we just pack them in there, and they're making it work.
So when it comes to deciding what program to program during this summer month, does theater work well for the Egyptian in July?
Our big musical is usually the July musical, so we pick the one that we think will sell the most tickets and appeal to a broader crowd. But for the most part, our shows have been successful. We've had a couple of July shows that flopped, and there was no rhyme or reason for it. They were very popular shows, but I think it's kind of a tradition. It's not something we want to get rid of. We shortened it. We used to do it for the entire month of July. Now we just do it for 3 weekends. And so, it's usually very popular. Musicals are like number 2 for our sponsors, the number 2 thing they want to see after concerts and musicians that they know and love. So it's definitely part of our mission statement and what we want to bring for the community.
Okay. So, again, as I mentioned, opening up Friday and then playing through the 21st, what, after this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
That's correct. Uh-huh. And we'll have the reduced price ticket night on Thursday.
Okay. And showtime then again, 8 o'clock, or Sundays at 6.
That's correct.
ParkCitySHows.com. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I hope everybody comes to see it. It's a work of love for me, and so much passion involved in the cast members. So, it's a really amazing show. It was cast well, and we have a couple of locals in the show. And so I hope people come out and show their support, and that it'll appeal to tourists and visitors alike.
Okay. Amber Hansen, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.